Hello, and welcome to this episode of Tea at the Palace, the podcast where myself, Robert Hardman, royal biographer, journalist, and my fellow royal expert, Wesley Kerr, take you beyond the palace gates. We explore the great royal stories of modern times and the stories behind the stories.
This podcast is all about sharing those moments, memories, and insights that you genuinely won't have heard anywhere else. But it's not just about them, the royal family. It's about all our yesterdays. It's about our history and about modern society as well.
And today we're going to be discussing the theme of dictators at the palace. But before we come on to that, I think it's worth setting the stage. Really, we're looking at the Queen as a stateswoman. That's what she was. Queen Elizabeth II met more world leaders, travelled further, met more people than any other monarch in history. And of course, many of them became great, great friends. I mean, one thinks wares of the likes of Nelson Mandela, for example, or Ronald Reagan.
I mean, Nelson Mandela called her Elizabeth. She called him Nelson. I remember being at the Albert Hall when he starts dancing in the royal box, looks at her, she gets up, she starts dancing. I'm like, I'll never forget that. So this is the most significant diplomatic career, you could argue, in sort of British history, certainly in terms of its longevity, longer than anybody else's diplomatic career. So when she becomes queen, Stalin is still ruling Russia. Mao Zedong has just taken over China. Churchill's her first prime minister. Yes, she only reigns, but really, in some ways, in diplomacy, you know, her influence is enormous. She almost rules. And we'll see that she really had to take the rough with the smooth. But it's some of the great figures in world history. Reagan, as you say, I mean, that almost the height of his presidency was spending an hour riding at Windsor with her.
And that started a very close friendship.
It's incredible, her impact across the world, across the Commonwealth. Not so much in doing deals, but in preserving a certain image of Britain and really, you know, batting for Britain.
And so, of course, those were the happy friendships, the great, the strong, enduring friendships, the great alliances, if you like. But I think what we're going to look at today is when she had to put up with some really pretty A-grade, ghastly people. She was expected, because she's a servant of the state, and when the state says, Your Majesty, we would like you to do X or Y, that's what she does. That's what the king does now. I think just before we get on to what we're going to call dictators at the palace, we might just have a little reflection on how royal visits in and out come about, because it's not a question of who the queen wants to have to stay, is it, Wes? And it's not a question of where she wants to go. She has to follow the advice of her foreign secretary and her prime minister, doesn't she?
It's very much the Foreign Office and the Commonwealth Office put together a programme, often going ahead years, and it's tied in with whatever the government of the day, Conservative or Labour or coalition government, with their priorities. So yes, she's the head of the state, but she's also kind of the tool of the state, and she's kind of got to act on advice, but she's then the one that's got to be one-to-one with the leader. So there's quite a lot of role, not for independent diplomatic action, but quite a lot of scope for her charm and her skill and increasingly her experience. So I suppose in the beginning of the reign, she's not very experienced, but she still doesn't make any mistakes.
And she gets thrown in very early on. I mean, you know, 1956, she's expected to entertain Bulganin and Khrushchev in Windsor Castle.
Who were then vying as to who was the top dog for the succession to Stalin. And it's interesting when she receives them at Windsor, because there's a picture of Tsar Alexander I in the drawing room, and she's a bit worried about how that will go down.
Well, as it turns out, she went down a storm. I talked to Prince Philip about this once, and he told me that when these two great Soviet leaders came, they were bowled over by the sight of the Tsar. And so, no, he's a great patriotic figure, because, of course, he was the Tsar who
saw off Napoleon. And did they then not take Bulganin and Khrushchev to the red drawing room?
Prince Philip said, yes, we had to sort of take them somewhere for tea. We thought the red drawing room would be appropriate. And off they went. But, I mean, that's you know, she's only been on the throne at that point 4 years. And already, you know, here is one of those moments where she is expected. These are difficult, tricky customers, but they want to meet her. And so she has to meet
them. And there's a lot of jeopardy, not only here, but in the return visits, as it were. So in India, 3 million people turn out, I think, 1961. But yeah, there's a lot of jeopardy in being in an open car. The famous visit to Ghana, where the government says, you know, we're very worried, but she ends up dancing with Nkrumah and charming him. Then some of the visits at home become controversial. The Greek royals, the Japanese emperor.
Greek royals, that led to the Queen being booed on her way into the Royal Opera House at Covent Garden. That was a very strange experience for her. They weren't booing her, they were booing the Greek monarch. But, you know, that's the collateral damage that comes with being head of state.
And when Hirohito came, I think the first Japanese emperor since, you know, the appalling treatment of British prisoners of war, there were people that turned their back on the procession.
Yeah, it was a very strange procession. I mean, normally going down the mall, the Queen would expect to be cheered and applauded, and she was greeted in total silence. But this is, as we say, this is what you have to do when your government says, right, will you entertain these people? Now, coming on to the low points of the, shall we say, the Palace Visitors book, I think things really do start to plumb new depths, shall we say, in the 70s. And let's reflect on someone who came for lunch in July 1971, Idi Amin.
Idi Amin, an extremely controversial figure who had seized power from the legitimate government of Uganda, led by Milton Obote, who made the mistake of going to a Commonwealth conference in Singapore in 1970. And while he was away, one of his generals suddenly took over. And the British government at first was rather pleased that Milton Obote had been slightly difficult over Edward Heath's desire to sell weapons to the apartheid regime. And they thought that Amin would be somebody that they could, as it were, do business with. He turned out to be rather a grotesque figure.
He soon lived up to the billing. The Queen had one of her files she'd always get before any visit, which it was called Personality Notes. And in it did warn her that she was dealing with someone who was, I think the phrase was, practically illiterate. But, as you say, the Heath government were very keen to try and do business with Amin. And he said, initially, you know, I want to come. I'm very proud to be a member of the Commonwealth. I want to come to London. I want to meet the Queen. So this is arranged by the Foreign Office in Downing Street. Amin comes to lunch, and then over lunch, takes the Queen into his confidence and admits he's got a plan. And he says he needs basically access to the sea. His country, Uganda, is landlocked. So he tells her that he's planning to invade neighbouring Tanzania to establish a corridor to the sea. Now, this isn't a very clever thing to do with the Queen, because the Queen is great friends with Julius Nyerere, who is the sort of founding
President,
father.
Yes.
Who's a great
President
sort of mild...
President of Tanzania, who she really liked.
She really likes. He's a religious character. He's staunch Catholic. He spends his spare time translating Shakespeare, I think, into Swahili. So it's not a good move, is it?
Well, she feels that she's got to do something about this. So much for the Queen keeping a secret. But when she hears that one Commonwealth country is planning to invade another, she very, very quickly alerts the Foreign Office and warns them of this plan, and that kind of scuppers it. So here's an example of the Queen really listening and taking direct and decisive action. She probably doesn't tell Amin that she's going to warn them, so she keeps Amin on side, with later rather awkward consequences.
Yes, so Amin remains a sort of bogeyman, really, right the way through the 70s. But it's a very interesting example, as you say, how the Queen, over one lunch, managed to avert a small war. But let's fast forward a bit, because not long after that, just a couple of years later, in fact, someone else gets invited to come and stay. This time it's not just for lunch. This is the Heath government arranging a full state visit for President Mobutu of Zaire.
Another very controversial African leader, but I mean very colourful, but certainly a dictator. And there's a really quite difficult protocol issue when Mobutu Sese Seko, the president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, known as Zaire at the time, is invited. And his wife does something which is really not allowed in terms of what she hides in the luggage.
Yeah, it really is. It's one of the most extraordinary breaches of it's good manners, really, as well as protocol, I think, during the Queen's reign. Not long after the Mobutus have arrived at the palace, then the palace kitchen gets a call from Mrs. Mobutu, who's in the Belgian suite. The Queen puts her state visitors in this very smart wing of the palace called the Belgian suite. And the kitchens get a call from Mrs. Mobutu, who's actually Marie Antoinette Mobutu, rather wonderfully. Marie Antoinette rings down to the kitchens and orders some raw meat. And they think this is a slightly odd request. Anyway, it turns out Footman takes a raw meat up, and it turns out Mrs. Mobutu has smuggled her pet dog into Buckingham Palace in the luggage. Now, this is the early 70s, a time, I don't know if you remember,
the rabies panic.
Everyone was terrified of rabies. You know, at that stage, it was all over Europe. It wasn't in Britain. Incredibly strict quarantine protocols for any sort of movement of animals. And here was someone who brought a dog from who knows where into the palace. And I talked to a couple of people who were in the palace at the time, and they were very funny about this. They said that they had never seen the Queen as angry. She summoned her deputy master of the household, Patrick Plunkett, Lord Plunkett, and memorably said to him, "Get that dog out of my house." And despite the fact the state visit is still underway, they basically have to kidnap the dog, remove it. The corgis by now have already been whisked off to Windsor. They've got them straight out of there. The dog has to be put in quarantine. Somehow the state visit carries on in what must be, shall we say, a fairly chilly temperature.
Frosty atmosphere.
But it's another reminder. And people say, you know, why on earth was Mobutu invited in the first place? Classic example of what was going on in the 70s was that Britain was very keen to try and get a portion of a big new hydroelectric deal in Zaire. And the idea was, well, if we get this man over, if we suck up to him, give him a nice time, he'll give British companies some contracts. That was the deal. Guess what? It never happened. We send him home on his way. He went home with a loan of £1 million, and we never saw a single penny of contract. But that led on to an even worse visit.
Well, it's a constant theme, isn't it, in the 70s, that Britain, perhaps a declining world power in terms of hard power, is trying to use the soft power of the monarch to kind of be big on the world stage. So, and there's this series of dictators, and none worse, I think, than Nicolae Ceaușescu, the president of Romania, and his wife, who were invited in 1978. And there's quite a long history to this. It goes back, I think, again to the Heath government, and it's takes ages to negotiate. And of course, there's a big aircraft deal hopefully at stake here. They're hoping to sell planes to the communist regime, and it's thought that Ceaușescu is a kind of good communist. So this is still the height of the Cold War. But Ceaușescu has sort of fallen out slightly with the Soviet government and had his own independent policy. But he was a sort of really quite a wicked man in terms of how he conducted himself.
He certainly was. He was even the Soviets actually regarded him as the most authoritarian leader in the Eastern Bloc. But as you say, the Heath government saw that he was an independent voice within the sort of communist bloc, and therefore maybe this is someone we could do business with. Maybe this is a way we can, as it were, sort of create a bit of daylight between Romania and Moscow. And at the same time, he let it be known that he was interested in building a Romanian aviation industry, and he would be happy to do this in partnership with the UK. So at a time of absolute economic chaos in Britain, we'd just been through the loan from the IMF, with Britain nearly bankrupt, and suddenly there is this prospect of a big new deal to build lots of planes, hundreds of planes in Eastern Europe with Romania. So the government by now, even though it was the idea of the Heath government, it was Harold Wilson who issued the invitation. Jim Callaghan is actually the Prime Minister by the time this visit happens. And once again, the government says to the Queen, "We've got someone. We would like you to have them to stay. They may not be very nice, but I'm afraid they're going to stay with you, not with us." And so Ceaușescu is invited, and he's absolutely delighted. He comes over to Britain. Everybody, amazingly, within the establishment, on all the parties, is very keen to suck up to this guy because they think, again, money, deals, aviation. Yeah, OK, he might have a terrible human rights record, but this could be good for our economy. But there are one or two lone voices out there who actually stand up and say, "Hang on, what the hell are we doing being nice to this person?" There weren't many, but one of them was a great Cold Warrior, Nick Bethell, Lord Bethell, the fourth Lord Bethell, sadly no longer with us. But I'm very delighted to say that today we're joined by his son, James Bethell, the fifth Lord Bethell, fifth Baron Bethell, who joins us now from the House of Lords. Hello, Lord Bethell, if I can call you James or even Jim, but hello.
Hello, Robert.
Very nice to see you. If I could just quickly begin by asking you, we always ask our guests on this show if they could bring or allude to or tell us about some bit of regalia, memorabilia, souvenir, whatever it is, that maybe touches on what we're talking about today. Can I ask maybe, what have you got with you?
I have with me my father's autobiography, Spies and Other Stories, which tells in really clear detail about his efforts to fight the Soviet system and to stand up for dissidents who were overlooked by the great powers, but went on to be proven correct that the forces of communism and oppressors like Ceausescu were really very wrong, and we should have done a lot more to help them.
And just remind us, because you know you were growing up in this period in a sort of Cold War household. I mean, tell us about your father's campaign to as it were remind the West what the East was really like.
Well, he had studied Russian during the Cold War in a Nissan hut in Fife, taught by Cossacks, and learned a passion for the Russian nation and its language, and translated Solzhenitsyn. But he virulently hated the Soviet system and the oppression of people across the Eastern Bloc. And when it came to Ceausescu, he had a particular dislike for the trumped-up nastiness of the Ceausescu couple, and was horrified when, really against his advice and all sensible people, it was decided by the Heath government to extend a state visit to the Ceausescus, to Buckingham Palace, because he was such a revolting and oppressive man.
So why was Ceausescu so bad as a dictator? What were his particular crimes?
I think that, at essence, he was the most narcissistic of all of them. His psychology was completely monomaniacal. He didn't trust anyone. He had a psychotic dislike for the Hungarian minority and oppressed them particularly badly. And he co-opted many of the excellent Romanian professional classes, the doctors, the lawyers, and the really wonderful professionals of Bucharest, and in a very nasty fashion used them to trick the nation into believing that he alone was the lord and master of this really very proud, rich, and wonderful country. And he set up a regime that was entirely focused on him and his wife, Elena, and caused utmost misery to the people, was extremely tough on the children, as you may remember, and obliged couples to have many children, and brought many up in orphanages under circumstances of huge cruelty.
Well, I'm very glad that you mentioned Elena Ceausescu, because they really were. They were a double act. What's fascinating when you look at the Foreign Office files in the run-up to this state visit is it's been made very clear by the Romanian authorities to the British Embassy in Bucharest that this trip is only going to be deemed a success, that these all this great aviation industry, all these contracts, all these untold millions and billions, it's all dependent on Britain coming up with a decent honorary doctorate or degree for Elena Ceausescu. She takes herself terribly seriously as a sort of genius chemist. I mean, her credentials are bogus in the extreme, but she sees herself as a great thinker, as a great scientist. And so you do find this rather hilarious race as the Foreign Office go around all the universities all around the United Kingdom saying, look, could one of you please give Mrs. Ceausescu an honorary something or other? Because if you don't, it's going to be really embarrassing. And what happens, Wes?
Well, in the end, they nearly all say no, but eventually, what was then the Central London Polytechnic agrees to give her an honorary degree, and also through a connection, the Royal Society of Chemistry, I think, yes, says that they're going to make her a fellow of some kind. And so she's absolutely delighted and accepts both of these offers. But I think there's been a big shopping around before then, and it's a slightly undignified exercise, but it shows the lengths, really, that the British government was prepared to go through and to put the palace to sort of honour these rather unpleasant guests.
Well, and meanwhile, I mean, at the palace, they're starting to worry, because just before the Ceausescus arrive, the Queen gets a call. She gets basically a warning from her fellow head of state, President Giscard d'Estaing of France, rings her up and says, look, I just ought to let you know, we've just had the Ceausescus to stay in Paris. And he said they basically trashed the joint. They'd left their rooms. They'd stolen lamps, vases, ashtrays, that sort of thing. But not only that, they'd actually hacked holes in the walls.
Because they thought there were recording devices.
They thought there were bugs. Yes. So as soon as the Queen heard this, she got straight onto the master of the household and said, look, for heaven's sake, if it whatever moves, take it out of the Belgian suite, because they're going to nick it. And there was a big scare at the palace that actually the Ceausescus were going to do this there. As it happened, they didn't. I think it's a very interesting mark of the respect for the Queen was that you did hear these stories of how badly behaved they were in other countries. But actually, when they came to London, to the palace, they behaved very well. And I talked to various people inside the Foreign Office of the day who remembered that, that there was something, there was a sort of awe, an aura around the Queen, that even someone as poisonous and thuggish as Ceausescu didn't want to, as it were, let her down.
So there was something entrancing about her, and I think there was something so spectacular about the welcome. So I wasn't at Victoria for that particular welcome, but the old style state visit, a train would chug into a special platform at Victoria Station, and there was would be a special pavilion with Her Majesty and the Duke and senior members of the household, the family, the Prime Minister. You'd sort of get off this chuggy train, and then the carriages would be there and would take a slightly circuitous route, Victoria Street, to the Mall. But there's something about that reception that was maybe so powerful, and her charm, that maybe the Ceausescus were entranced.
I think clearly they were. I mean, although there were a couple of... there were a few people brave enough to demonstrate. As I said earlier, most people just accepted, look, we've got it, this guy's going to bring some money, we'll put up with him. But there were a couple of demonstrations. And Jim, I think your father was certainly knew some of the demonstrators who had gathered firstly outside Victoria Station, where I think the British authorities, to their discredit, parked a couple of buses in front of them so that Ceausescu couldn't see them. And then I think there were a couple of other demonstrations, were there? I know that there were even arrests, and your father got involved in that, didn't he?
So there was a very small band of... This was a very obscure cause in Britain, you know, championing Romania. Hardly anyone knew who it was. It was such a self-contained and autarkic state that no one really cared about it. But there were dissidents who put together banners and placards, sought to try and make their point. And it was it doesn't reflect well, frankly, on us as a nation that we bundled them into a police van and took them away from the Mall where they were congregated, so that they wouldn't embarrass Ceausescu and the party. And I regret that that happened. And we should reflect on that as we handle visits these days from China and other uncomfortable regimes. We should never, ever do anything like that again.
But your father must have been very upset. This was presumably what he had feared when he'd warned against the visit.
Yes. The thing that his insight, which was right, is that that visit would be used with tremendous energy by the Ceausescus internally, and that we shouldn't underestimate the power of that endorsement. If you're a trumped-up dictator in a tin pot regime in a country like Romania, meeting the Queen is a hell of a validation. And he used to bang on about it for years and years afterwards, and he used it in the state propaganda machine extensively. And when I went to Romania soon after the revolution in 1989, everyone knew about it and mentioned it to me as though Britain had gone a long way to try and endorse Romania. Now, that wasn't our supposed intention, but that is how it came across to the Romanians themselves. And that was my father's frustration, is that we completely underestimated and were naive about what Ceausescu himself would do with this massive endorsement, putting the Queen, frankly, in a very difficult position.
Your father, of course, must have made that point to ministers. I mean, like David Owen, who was the Foreign Secretary at the time, now says that it was a terrible mistake and he can't remember sort of authorising it. But your father, who was very well connected, must have made these points to ministers at the time, just as you're making them now.
Yes, he was an energetic letter writer and wrote very powerful and thoughtful notes to ministers on these matters, some of which were very effective. And he had a very strong relationship with Margaret Thatcher, who instinctively completely understood these points and was very impactful in her visits to see Gorbachev and Lech Walesa in Poland.
Well, David Owen, to be fair to him, and I've talked to him about it, I mean, he never authorised the visit. There's a note on a document in the files a few days before the Ceausescus arrived saying, who authorised this visit? Did I? If I did, I regret it. And as we've discussed, actually, and the origins, the genesis of all this was the Heath government, and it was Harold Wilson who issued the invitation. So Owen effectively just inherited this visit. The Queen, of course, is the person who's expected to roll out the red carpet, to smile, to have this person to stay in her house for a whole week. And there are all sorts of peculiar arrangements that the palace, they found utterly bizarre. For example, one thing that that I was told by staff at the time was that the Ceausescus were so paranoid that palace staff might try and poison their clothes, that all their clothing came in hermetically sealed plastic containers. And no member of the palace staff, normally if you go and stay with the Queen, you know, you get people unpack all your bags, hang everything up, wash your clothes. No one was allowed anywhere near it. The Ceausescu's wardrobe was just in these, as I said, these sort of plastic boxes where they couldn't be touched. But that was partly because at this time, such was Cold War paranoia. I mean, I don't know if you recall, Wes, but there was this was around the time of Georgi Markov. You remember Georgi Markov?
Oh, yes.
Well, Jim, I think you know Georgi Markov? I mean, maybe you could reflect on what was going on in the country at that time.
Yes, well, we knew him very well indeed. His wife, Annabel, was a very good friend of ours and is my brother's godmother. And my father published Georgi's books, and he had a small publishing company.
And just remind us what happened. Just remind us what happened to Georgi Markov, because I can sense this is what's going through Ceausescu's mind.
I remember my father had our house full of dissidents from all sorts of countries. And he would spend hours and hours phoning them up in Eastern Europe, trying to get past the snoopers on the exchanges. And often people would turn up in our house with envelopes, with messages, and sometimes transcripts. He, for instance, received transcripts for some of Solzhenitsyn's books, which he translated into English and had published. In 1978, when I was about 9 years old, we were publishing the book for Georgi Markov. And I should say, I mean, the thing that one sometimes misses about these things, he was like a sort of Vaclav Havel type figure. He was incredibly charismatic and funny. And he, if you were looking for a sort of alternative national leader or someone who was going to run a sort of meaningful commentary on your country, you know, Georgi was really a powerful guy. He wasn't some dopey poet who just noodled on words. He was a really moving figure. And Georgi was working at the BBC, at the Bulgarian service. And as he crossed Waterloo Bridge, someone did something strange with an umbrella, jabbed him in the leg and dropped the umbrella, which he mentioned to Annabel when he got home. And a few days later, he fell very seriously ill and died. And it seems that he was deliberately assassinated in the most extraordinary fashion by the Bulgarian secret police.
This is the sort of the climate we're talking about when the Ceausescus are in London, this absolute mutual distrust. And yet here is a man every bit as bad as the Bulgarian leader, Zhivkov. I mean, you've got the Ceausescu, and he's staying with the Queen. And it, looking back on it, it's extraordinary that in that period, when this sort of thing is going on, that we're rolling out the red carpet for this guy.
Well, if I could just add to that, don't forget that the political establishment in Britain fully supported détente. So there was a split. Some people thought, you know what, the Russians have got their own way of doing things. With us and our empire and racism, are we really so great? Do we really have a monopoly on wisdom here in the West? Maybe we should let them be who they are and we'll do our own thing. And there were others like my father who believed much more in the absolute evil of the autocracy in the East and of the Soviet system and were deeply skeptical of the pretense by leaders like Ceausescu of being reasonable or helpful people.
Well, guess what? I don't think your father was invited to the state banquet, was he?
No, he wasn't.
But all sorts of others were lining up to come. The Queen, though, Wes, I mean, she could see right through him, couldn't she?
I think she always referred to him thereafter as a frightful little man. And even during the visit, she did whatever she could to spend minimal time, because theoretically they're her house guests. You're meant to, like, have breakfast with them, meant to chat with them. So there's a moment when they're in the garden, and the Ceausescus had all of their meetings in the garden so they wouldn't be eavesdropped.
Again, this paranoia. They think everyone's bugging them, poisoning them.
She,
so they're
she of course, is taking one of her regular constitutional walks with the dog in the garden, and she spies the Ceausescus and hides behind a bush, not something that the Queen of the United Kingdom often did.
No, that's absolutely right. She did do that. She told the great writer, Sir Anthony Jay. I remember he told me that story about how she said, well, I really didn't have anything to say to them. I don't know what to say to them. I don't want to see them. And I just love the thought, the image of the Queen in the garden in Buckingham Palace, sort of, you know, whispering to the dogs, shh, you know, they're coming, hiding behind a bush. But that's, I mean, what an extraordinary visit.
So if the visit was for like an aircraft deal, what happened to the deal?
Yes, so this whole visit is created around this aviation contract that's meant to create thousands of jobs in Britain, thousands of jobs in Romania, and lead to this whole fleet of east-west aircraft, this BAC-111, this sort of mid-range airliner being built both in Britain and Romania. And of course, they sign the deal, nothing happens. However, that's not the only legacy of this trip. There's always the ritual exchange of gifts on a state visit, where each side gives the other something. In the Queen's case, she gave Ceausescu a hunting rifle, which is something he particularly wanted, and he gave her a pair of handmade rugs. God knows what's happened to them. I haven't seen them anywhere prominent at the palace, put it that way. But what she also gave him, there's always the ritual exchange of gifts. So maybe you know what...
A very senior order. She made him a Knight Grand Cross of the Order of the Bath, one of the oldest orders, with a marvellous chapel at Westminster Abbey, which now looks really, really rather grotesque that he should have been given this very, very high order of chivalry.
And the initials of that are what?
GCB.
GCB. So he gets this I think it was sort of what Nilsson and people like that now, doesn't it?
It's one of the oldest orders, this most senior English order after the Garter, yeah, with a wonderful chapel and a stall.
And a red
Westminster
sash.
Abbey. Yes, I don't know if he ever wore it, but it ended up being taken away from him.
I think
him.
He did wear it. He was so pleased to have it. He wore it to the banquet the Queen held in his honour. Yeah, yeah, you can see.
With
his lounge suit, because everyone else is in white tie, and he's being a Soviet leader in his lounge suit, but he wore it. So, yes, he goes home with a contract that he has no intention of honouring. And as James was saying earlier, the kudos of this visit, but he's got sort of proof of it, hasn't he, James? He's actually got regalia.
He does. I mean, he has this extremely expensive award, valued around £15,000 at the time. But more than that, it's the ability to make it sound to the Romanian people that he's had tea with the Queen and been validated by her, and that is invaluable.
There wasn't really a happy ending to all this, well, certainly not for the Ceausescus.
He starts the construction of an enormous palace in Bucharest, which they never get to live in. But there's a catastrophic ending for the Ceausescus. In 1989, there's a huge rebellion against the rationing and the economic collapse, and they're shot. Christmas 1989 is part of that rebellion.
Just the Berlin Wall, everything coming down, Eastern Europe.
I remember it absolutely dominated the news bulletins that Christmas, but it was a very, very chilling end and a rather strange chapter, but the Queen had always distrusted them.
So, yeah, there is that famous image, isn't there, Wes, of these two bodies lying there in the snow on Boxing Day 89. I mean, extraordinary end to this deplorable regime. But it doesn't quite end there, because although he's dead, he has gone to his maker, still Nicolae Ceausescu, GCB. He's still got this medal from the Queen, this regalia. Except, I think, at this point, Lord Bethel, your father, James, he's got something to say about this, hasn't he?
Well, he felt very sorely that the Queen's good reputation had been used to buttress these horrible dictators. And he was worried that their acolytes would take over. And it became a point of principle, point of honour for him, that the decoration should be returned to the Queen, which is what would normally happen in any case. It is practice to return the decoration to the Queen. And he wrote extensively, both to the Romanian government and to the British government, to try to chase the valuable piece down.
Eventually, he was rewarded, because miraculously, when you think that palace was ransacked, I mean, everything the Ceausescus had was sort of pulled to pieces by a justifiably angry mob after that revolution. But they found it. They found the GCB. They found the regalia in a drawer, and it was eventually handed back. But Wes, I mean, do you think Britain learned any lessons from this Ceausescu episode?
Well, Britain, the government, continues to use the monarchy as the tool of diplomacy for good or ill. And I mean, the Queen normally comes out very well, and the King comes out very well. Putin, of course, was invited in 2003 on a state visit. At that time, he was at the height of, I'll call it, popularity, and we didn't know about his dark side, but he had the full trimmings, the carriage procession down the Mall, staying at the palace. Apparently, David Blunkett was told by the Queen that the dogs were very suspicious of him, and that dogs have a very good instinct. But But there was the full British magisterium behind Putin, as it has been between the last two Chinese leaders. But I suppose the monarch is the tool of diplomacy.
Well, I think that is a very good reminder that actually, as the king himself said at his coronation, I come to serve. And that's what monarchs do. However much we might think there is agency in a lot of these things, they have to do what we, the state, ask them to do. And I think that's a point worth remembering. It just remains me to thank our guest, James Bethel, Lord Bethel. Jim, thank you very much for coming on and reminding us of a very dark, but a dark period in European history, but one with a few bright lights in it, not least your dad.
Thank you, Wes. Thank you, Robert. It's been a real privilege to be on the show.
And sadly, we have reached the end of this week of Tea at the Palace. So please join us again soon.
Please like and leave a review of the show on your podcast app of choice.
Tea at the Palace is a Folding Pocket production.